electron has been split. Kind of.
What we observe is that the electron that's excited starts propagating in the lattice, but it, in doing so, it splits up into two separate particles.
Time dilation, biology style, investigating neural relativity in the lab.
We don't know what time is outside of the brain. What we do know for certain is that it is malleable, and depending on what's going on with your brain and things that we do to you in the laboratory, we can make time stretch and bend and reverse.
And a tabletop test of quantum gravity.
Normally, when you think about the Planck scale, this is an experimentally completely inaccessible length scale.
You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
First up, here's something I never thought I'd be saying. The electron has been split into two particles.
Surely not.
Okay, well, it's not quite that simple. But as reported in Nature on April the 18th, physicists have broken a single electron inside a sample of strontium cuprate into two quasi-particles, a spinon, and making its first ever appearance in the lab, an orbiton. Earlier, I spoke with team member Jeroen van den Brink, a physicist at the Institute for Theoretical Solid State Physics in Dresden, Germany, who explained the special conditions needed to split this otherwise elementary particle.
The weird thing is that if you have an electron, a free electron, it's an elementary particle which you cannot split into two different particles. An atomic nucleus, right, can be split into protons and neutrons or whatever you have, but the electron cannot when it's just sitting there out by itself. However, if you have electrons inside solids, this changes or can change, and this is what we've shown. It is really true that an electron is sitting in this copper oxide material, which has a special property that electrons inside it can only move in one direction. So it's a one-dimensional system. So now these electrons sitting inside the solid and only being able to move in either forward or backward, we can excite them. And if we do, what we observe is that the electron that's excited starts propagating in the lattice, but it's, in doing so, it splits up into two separate particles. And these two particles actually have different velocities. So you can think of one particle moving with a high speed and the other particle with a lower speed, or even in the opposite direction.
The electron is able to be split into two quasi-particles when inside a solid because, according to quantum mechanics, in this situation, the electron takes on wave-like characteristics.
Or one can think of the electron as a particle sitting somewhere in your system, but you can also think about it as a wave. So then if this electron is excited, locally you create a wave, so to say. And this wave starts now propagating in your one-dimensional channel, as it were. And when it starts propagating, it separates into separate waves, one carrying the magnetic characteristic of the electron and the other one carrying the what's called orbital moment of the electron.
The team split the electron by firing a high-energy beam of X-ray photons at it. The beam excited the electron into a higher atomic energy level, or orbital. The excited electron then split into two quasi-particles, a spinon, carrying its magnetic spin property, and an orbiton, carrying its orbital location. Team member Christoph Wohlfeld, also at the Institute for Theoretical Solid State Physics in Dresden, explains how it was possible to infer that the spinon and orbiton had been created, and had sped off in opposite directions, by looking at the energy loss of the photons in the X-ray beam as the beam rebounded off the electron.
The way how we did it was that firstly, experimented it just the spectrum of energy loss of these photons lost in the system. And this spectrum has some particular characteristics, has some particular shape. So that was thought of like, okay, so we calculated several spectra based on several models, and only the one which assumed that this separation of spin and orbital happened could reproduce this experimental spectrum.
Physicists have actually known since the 1980s that it should be possible to split the electron into three particles, the spinon, the orbiton, and also the holon carrying the electron's charge. Indeed, 15 years ago, experimenters split the electron into the spinon and holon. But so far, nobody has managed to create the spinon, orbiton, and holon at the same time. But Jeroen van den Brink says that is the next challenge.
The real advantages in the field have become possible by the instrumentation that's become more and more precise all the time. So I think you will need another order of magnitude improvement of your energy resolution to see more sophisticated three-particle processes as a separation spin charge and orbital. It's an obvious next thing to try.
Thank you to Jeroen van den Brink there and also to Christoph Wolfelt. For links to the paper and to an article about how the orbiton could help to explain a decades-long mystery about the origin of high-temperature superconductivity and also aid in the quest to build a quantum computer, visit the FQXI website, www.fqxi.org/community. You know, I really enjoyed conducting those interviews. Time just whizzed by as I spoke to the researchers.
I was going to say, I found listening to it a bit of a drag. But then, as Einstein said, time is relative. We've all experienced time flying when we're having fun, and if we're unlucky, slowing when we're in a life-threatening situation. Neuroscientist David Eagleman of the Baylor College of Medicine has been conducting experiments to test how our perception of time changes in certain circumstances, and has even gone as far as throwing his graduate students off buildings to understand the effects of fear on the way we experience time. He told Zia about some of his various ingenious lab tests to create time illusions and his idea that these may be related to schizophrenia.
The interesting thing is that there's a neural relativity, meaning that how time goes inside your head and in my head can be quite different from one another. And in my laboratory, we can very easily make you think that something lasted longer or shorter than it actually did, or we can make you think that something came before something else when it was in fact the other way around, or we can make you think that two things were simultaneous that weren't, or that a flicker rate is going at a different rate than it actually is. And what this all teaches us is that time is not a river flowing past that we're passively tracking. Instead, it's something that the brain is actively constructing. And just like there are visual illusions, there are illusions of time. And what this teaches us is that time is not what we thought it was exactly.
So can you describe some of these experiments that you've carried out in your laboratory? How can you trick people into thinking that, say, two things that happened at the same time didn't?
Well, here's an example of something. Several years ago, we discovered that if you press a button and that causes a flash of light, then you'll take credit for that, for having caused that. Now let's say we inject a small delay, so when you hit the button, a tenth of a second passes before the light. So you press the button and there's a light with a little bit of delay. Your brain takes credit for that, and as it keeps pressing the button, it starts adapting to that delay, and it starts to feel like the light and the flash are happening at the same time. Now imagine that we suddenly remove that delay. So now you press the button and the light happens instantly. You will now believe that the light happened before you pressed the button. This is an illusory reversal of action and effect. You'll hit the button and you'll say, it wasn't me. The light happened just before I got there. And so you won't take credit for it. And what struck me as interesting is when I noticed participants in the laboratory doing this and saying, wow, it wasn't me, I realized, that sounds so much like what schizophrenic patients do, is they have something called credit misattribution, which is that they'll do something and they won't take credit for it. They'll think somebody else caused it or somebody forced them to do it. And so then there's a florid story that follows that usually. But I thought, I wonder if schizophrenia is fundamentally a disorder of time perception, because if these very sophisticated systems in your brain aren't getting timing correctly, then you will have a very fragmented cognition, and it matches many of the primary symptoms that we see in schizophrenia.
And have you carried out any tests to check this hypothesis?
For the last year, we've been testing schizophrenic patients on various aspects of time perception. The initial data looks very promising. It turns out to be quite a difficult series of experiments because patients who are deeply psychotic have a very hard time taking the tests for other reasons. They're just not that good as far as participants go. And so these are just the challenges involved. But the data that we have been able to get that's clean, the data are very encouraging.
Another phenomenon that people often report is that, you know, when they're sort of their life is in danger, if they're sort of in a car accident or something, time seems to slow down. Is that something that you've investigated, and do you find sort of scientific evidence for that effect?
Yes. So my lab's the only lab to ever look at that problem, because you can imagine the difficulty of figuring out how do you actually get somebody into a life-threatening situation. It really does require a life-threatening situation for people to experience this impression that something took much longer than it actually did. And so we developed a way of measuring this by creating a device that essentially flashes information at people very quickly, too quickly for them to see under normal circumstances. And then we put them in a life-threatening situation to ask, can they now read the information if time is really going in slow motion? And the situation we put them in was dropping them from a 150-foot tall tower in free fall, falling backwards, and they get caught in a net below. And what we asked, it was a very short experiment, just a few seconds. On the way down, we're asking if they can actually see the numbers that are being flashed.
And so what did you find? Does time slow down when you're in a life-threatening situation?
So it turns out when people are dropped from this 150-foot tall tower, they believe that the duration was much longer than it actually was. So there is this duration distortion that people very clearly experience. But they do not see in slow motion, we discovered. It turns out that their speed at which they can see information is exactly the same as ground-based controls. So what this taught us is that duration is something that can be modulated separately from other aspects of time. You can see things at a certain rate, and yet you can believe that something took so much longer. This presumably has to do with the amount of energy that your brain is burning in an emergency situation. It's using all of its resources. Memories are getting laid down very densely, and your brain's working very hard. As a result, duration feels like it lasted much longer.
What about the other end of the spectrum? I mean, we often say that time flies when you're having fun. Have you seen that phenomenon?
It depends which direction you're asking it. So during a very fun event, it's often the case that you're not paying attention to the clock, and as a result, it seems like time zips by and you're surprised when it's over. However, retrospectively, when you've had an event that's very novel and full of all kinds of interesting and new things, it seems like it's taken a longer time. So when you come back from a three-day weekend of traveling in some exotic place, you feel as though it took a very long time. It was longer than usual three-day weekend. Similarly, when you're doing something very boring like an airplane flight, it seems to take forever while you're in it. But retrospectively, it's just the opposite. It seems as though it disappeared very quickly because you didn't really lay down any new memories during that event.
And is that related to this sense we have that time passed very slowly when we were children, but now it just, you know, as adults, it seems to go by much, much faster?
Yes, that's exactly right. So when you're a child, you're trying to figure out the rules of the world, and you are laying down lots of memories because everything is novel to you. As a result, when you look back at the end of a childhood summer, it seems like there's all sorts of footage you can draw on. In contrast, when you're an adult, you've sort of seen it all before. You get the structures of the world. And at the end of an adult summer, you look back and there was nothing really that new that happened. And so it seems to have zipped by in a flash.
So I guess my final question is, what would you say that time is?
We don't know what time is outside of the brain. What we do know for certain is that it is malleable. And depending on what's going on with your brain and things that we do to you in the laboratory, we can make time stretch and bend and reverse. And what that tells us is that whatever time is, it's not what we started off thinking that it was. So I don't know what time is, or even if it actually exists in the outside world, but what's clear is that our perception of time is built by the brain, and it depends on the brain. And I think the reason this is deeply important is because we build all of our physics on our intuitions about time. There's the letter T in the equation, and we all think we know what that is. And I think what this work shows is that we don't know what it is, and that if we strip away that psychological filter, there's something much more mysterious underneath.
That was David Eagleman explaining to Zia how he throws his graduate students off towers in the name of science.
And yet he's still less scary than some of the physics profs I know. You can also watch Eagleman talking about all this in more depth on the FQXI website, www.fqxi.org/community. Just click on the podcast link. We'd also love to hear what you think of the podcast and any suggestions that you have for future items. You can email us at podcast@fqxi.org and follow us on Twitter at FQXI. Which brings me to a question we're commonly asked. How do you pronounce FQXI?
FQXI.
Yes, that's pretty much the way. Though, as I learned at a recent quantum information science meeting in Oxford, many FQXI members refer to us as Foxy, which is both flattering and disturbing.
I will go with disturbing. Though, if you want to call us Foxy, we won't argue. But this was a meeting on quantum information science, QIS. Did you ask them if it was pronounced KISS?
No, I have to admit that I didn't ask them that. But I did ask FQXI member Marcus Aspelmeier of the University of Vienna about his recent Nature Physics paper with Czaslaw Bruckner and others. In it, they propose a relatively cheap and cheerful tabletop test of quantum gravity in the lab using current quantum optics technology. Various ideas about ways to unite quantum mechanics and gravity into a unified theory have been proposed, but hopes for testing them seem way beyond the powers of even the largest particle accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider. That's because testing those ideas involves looking down at unimaginably small distances. So, as Aspelmeier explains, even he didn't expect that it would be possible to test this regime, known as the Planck scale, in the lab.
So the reason why this result was surprising to all of us is that normally when you think about the Planck scale, which is on the order of 10 to the minus 35 meters, this is an experimentally completely inaccessible length scale. So there's no way that any experiment would ever achieve a resolution to directly access this regime of the Planck length.
And so what particular effect are you going to be looking for?
One particular aspect that seems to be inherent to many, if not all, approaches to theories of quantum gravity is the existence of an ultimate length scale. This is something that is alien to standard quantum theory as we know it, because in quantum theory we have Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which tells you that you can have arbitrary precision in a position measurement when you sacrifice your knowledge on the momentum. So that means you can, if you just put enough work and energy in, achieve spatial resolution and achieve sensitivity in space on the order and even below something like the Planck length if you just have sufficient uncertainty in the momentum of the system.
The team's idea is that you can measure modifications to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle by pushing a microscale mirror around in the lab with a laser pulse. On tiny scales, the mirror behaves like a wave, and calculations show that nudging the mirror in this way knocks its wave function out of step, giving it what is known as an additional phase.
It turns out now that the extra modification due to possible quantum gravity correction just adds a tiny extra phase. So if you take an object, a physical object, and move it around and you inscribe a closed loop, so you start at some point, you move around, come back to the very same point again, then the quantum mechanical wave function of this object actually gets an extra phase that is directly proportional to the area of the enclosed loop in phase space. We push our mechanical object around, so we push it around with a sequence of strong light pulses, and thereby manage to write this geometric phase of the mechanical system obtains in its during its travel in phase space onto our optical pulse. And the only thing we have to do in the end is we have to measure the optical pulse in order to obtain the phase.
So is this going to help you differentiate between different quantum gravity models in particular?
Actually, it turns out there are different proposals for modifications, and they indeed scale differently with the mass of the system, for example. Right? If in the long run one can build experiments where you can systematically change parameters such as mass and then perform those tests, then you can either exclude or, in case there is a positive outcome, even, let's say, provide some experimental backing of one of those possible approaches.
If you don't find any modification, what will that mean?
So first of all, if there would be a null result of those experiments, then this would actually help to put some boundaries for possible modifications of the uncertainty relation due to effects of quantum gravity, so due to the finite size ultimate length scale effects of quantum gravity. And I think this is, at this stage, the most valuable input that you can think of.
And how long do you think it's going to take to carry out these experiments and get some results?
So that's a very difficult prediction to make. The main challenge for these experiments, and at the same time this is the reason why this proposal works at all, is that we need to have a excellent control over massive mechanical resonators. So the only reason why we will eventually be able to enter this regime where you can test possible modifications is that those modifications scale with the mass of the system. And only when we go to sufficiently large, massive objects, only then will those additional phase shifts in the proposed experiments become significant, such that one should be able to observe it if it exists. So the challenge right now is to achieve this very high level of quantum optical control over such massive mechanical resonators. And I'm extremely confident that with all the tremendous progress we have seen there during the last years, that this experiment will be in reach soon. And the parameters that we suggest are not completely unrealistic, actually.
Actually, before I let you go, is there anything else that you want to say about this paper or anything else that you're working on?
This is the time where I can greet my grandma.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you to Marcus Aspelmeyer there. And also hello to Marcus's gran. It's also worth checking out FQXI member Sabine Hassenfelder's blog, Back Reaction, where she has a detailed post commenting on this proposal.
She's quite skeptical about whether it can work, right?
Yes, she is. Details are on the website www.fqxi.org/community. That's all we have time for, so thank you again to Jeroen van den Brink, Christoph Bolfeld, David Eagleman, and Marcus Aspelmeyer.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.